This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. I am JM, and with me as always are Becca and Mark. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Howdy.
Today we're going to talk about our first game that we're walking through in Gumshoe. We're talking about Trail of Cthulhu. And Mark brought up a really good point. This might be a good time if you are new to not just Iconic and everything else, but also to Lovecraft, to kind of explain a little bit about what Lovecraftian horror is. So this is Trail of Cthulhu, the book by Pelgrane Press that covers their tales of Lovecraftian horror. And H.P. Lovecraft was a horror writer in the early 1900s. He was very prolific. He worked very closely with Clark Ashton Smith and Robert E. Howard. They sent letters back and forth. He was very influenced by Lord Dunsany and his work. Sort of laid the foundation for what we call Lovecraftian or cosmic horror. And the idea behind cosmic horror is that, unlike the myths of old, where the myths tell the truths of the universe, our myths are a layer of lies that protect our sanity. And the deeper we dig into the actual truths and the origins of these myths and the origins of these stories and unexplained phenomena, we are tearing at the walls of our sanity. The universe is cruel. It is cold. It does not care about you. And the more you understand that, the less likely you are to be conceived as sane by everyone else. And so he wrote a large amount of stories. And it wasn't until after his death that others like August Derleth kind of forged them.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, into a cohesive, if you will, mythos with elder gods and outer gods and Azathoth and Haster. And his most famous of all of his gods was Cthulhu. We use the term gods just because of the vastness of the scale of their power and magnitude. But essentially, they are just cosmic beings that they barely register that humanity is around. And the idea is that when this, like most of these gods are dead, but when the stars are right, they will come back to life. And when that happens, humanity as we know it is over. Those who follow the elder gods, Sandy Peterson had a great description of this at Chaosium Con. They're not theists. They don't believe that Cthulhu is a god. They're atheists. They're materialists. They want, as Sandy put it, they want the money. Right. If you are a creative, you go after Haster because he inspires you to greater and greater acts of creativity, even at the cost of your sanity. If you like orgies, you go after Shub because the black goat of the woods will give you all of the sex and long life that you want. If you follow after Dagon, you do that because the riches of the sea are given to you. That is the world that we are stepping into in Trail of Cthulhu. So we're going to be talking today about how does Trail of Cthulhu take the Gumshoe system, which we talked about in our last two episodes, and make it unique. We're going to do a review and a walkthrough of the core rulebook. Then we're going to talk about what's coming up next month. So that's kind of our outline, but we're going to start with a comment from one of our Patreons. Escape Artist posted, I have a player who adores Gumshoe. I like it overall as a GM, but one of the things I find a little disappointing in the system is the fact that the parties are constructed in order to make sure every skill is covered, so you always get the clue as long as you look for it. I prefer the uncertainty of the game like Call of Cthulhu, where the clues can be missed and that can lead to other interesting situations, or force the players to come up with creative ways to find out what they need to know. I understand the idea of the core clues, and it's designed to ensure that the game never comes to a dead stop because of a bad roll. But really, in my games, I never let bad rolls force the game to come to a dead stop. Instead, there are opportunities for the unexpected and other avenues of inquiry. So we're going to talk about that a little bit before we delve into the rules, because we covered Gumshoe, so you should at least understand kind of the high level of this. And I think what's interesting to me is the couple of times we run Gumshoe, it shifts the focus from the finding of clues, which is really what the core issue that Robin is trying to address with the Gumshoe system, not the assembly of the clues. And so just because the players have all of the puzzle pieces and you've ensured that the puzzle comes together to be a horse does not mean your players will not assemble it into a rose and come to a completely wrong conclusion. So it shifts for me, it shifts the focus from, did I find the clue, into, I have all of these pieces, what the hell does this build? What about you guys? What are your thoughts on escape artists? Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, they even address it in the book. If you watch shows like House or CSI, it's not just here's a clue. You get so many clues. You have to figure out, one, how do they go together? And okay, just because I found a clue, does it mean anything, or is it a red herring? And it could be an intentional or unintentional. Think of CSI when they go through a crime scene, they find lots of evidence. Some of it doesn't mean anything. It's just right there.
And let's not put it past players.
You have to have the players then try to assemble that into something.
Yeah, and they'll come up with their own red herrings. They may find a matchbook to a seedy club, and that was your idea of a core clue. And they may think it's worthless. They may focus on something completely different, like the scent of the oil that comes off of it that you thought was a throwaway line. But they, as Mark said, if you say there's a blacksmith in town, suddenly the group does not care about the goblins raiding. They want to know the blacksmith's entire story because maybe that guy's behind it all.
And if you're playing with Becca, have the blacksmith, his wife, his children, parents, grandparents, back several generations, because she's going to want to know who they are and why they settled here.
That's why Becca is a delightful player.
Yes. That's right.
That's true. Both the delightful and the I need all the information. Well, it really depends on the character I play. But for a Cthulhu game, yeah, it's you need all the clues. I agree with Escape Artists in that, like, I've never let the game come to a dead stop because of bad rolls. However, I have definitely witnessed in playing Call of Cthulhu specifically how bad rolls can frustrate the players because they feel like they're not getting enough. Mm-hmm. And so Trail of Cthulhu kind of twists that and goes, okay, you feel like you're not getting enough here. You can take all of this, do with it as you will. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's no longer about, well, I didn't get enough information. Now it's about, okay, I have all this information. And as you said, what does it mean? Is it a horse or is it a rose? Or am I making this up completely? And it's neither. It's a soccer ball.
I really look forward to Becca's running a Trail of Cthulhu game for us and to see how she's going to be planning to do all of this.
A lot of it's going to be, here's all the clues. What'd you guys make of it? Oh, that? Yeah, no, that's totally what's going down. You're right. let me find the stats for that because, oh, no.
Well, and I will say it does require a little bit more planning on the part of the GM because you do need to sort of lay out at least one possible path that the clues can take. Because if you have a matchbook from a seedy bar, you need to know that in your mind that the matchbook will lead the players to the seedy bar if they choose to follow that. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It is a different tack, Escape Artist. I 100% agree than kind of what I'm used to. But I'm interested to see it even more in play. I run a couple of sessions of Nice Black Agents. I ran Trail of Cthulhu several times. They were both fun, but they are a different experience on the GM side of things. Mm-hmm. All right. So what can you expect out of the Trail of Cthulhu book? Well, it is, I did not write this down, 247 pages. And like 13th Age and a lot of the other Pellgrane products, it's all in one. So this book runs $40 and it's everything you need to run the game. It's got character creation, it's got rules, it's got GM advice, it's got setting advice of the 1930s, and it comes with an adventure. Everything you need. Oh, and a bestiary. So everything you need to run the game is in one book. Now you can, of course, expand upon that. Next month, we're going to talk a lot about the expansions. So let's get into character creation. Becca, you had a note here.
As I was reading through character creation, I definitely had to pull up one of the free character sheets that you can get off of Pelgrane Press, just so I could reference what was going on. And this is just how I figure out game mechanics, is like reading it and then aligning it with what's on your character sheet. However, then that also then led to discovering the plentiful free supplies and downloads that Pelgrane Press has, which was really nice.
Right. There's a lot, and we'll put a link in the show notes for this episode to their free resource page. There's also a gumshoe. It's called, it's either Black Books or Black Pages. It is a almost like a D&D Beyond kind of thing for Gumshoe, where you can create characters, you can track things as the GM, you can look up things. It's very slick. It is a pay, I should say it seems very slick, because it is a, there, you have to pay to enjoy it, all of the features. In creating a character, there's really like three or four steps. It's actually pretty simple. Becca found a nice, what is it? One page, six steps, breaks it down.
Yep.
So the first thing you do is you pick your occupation. What do you do? What did you do before the start of the adventure? There's a lot to choose from. What kind of stood out to you guys on these occupations? I really like The Alienist. I read the book The Alienist. I watched the TV show. I've read the second book in that series. So The Alienist is basically what psychiatrists were, or psychologists were called before we actually had psychologists. They were people who we believed that people who had mental illness were separated from their normal self. They were alienated from their normal self. And so alienists tried to delve into the what we would now term the psychology of people who were suffering from mental illness. And again, in Lovecraft's fiction, mental illness either arises naturally or is a sign of somebody interacting with the mythos. Their sanity shreds as they encounter the truth of the universe. So what about you? What occupations stood out to you guys?
I like fighter types, so I like the military one, and just for different reasons, and not just because he has all the rough 'em, shoot 'em. I just thought, this is 1930s. They didn't call it PTSD, but there was a lot of horror of World War One.
Oh man!
And I think that fits perfect into Cthulhu mythos. Is you've seen things, and people are like, oh yeah, he's a shell shock. No, I saw things that weren't real that strained my sanity, and either get pulled into it, maybe visiting an alienist to find out what's wrong, or just hearing rumors of, hey, these weird things are happening. And I go and investigate, you know, is it me or is this real?
Right.
Yeah. I find the list of occupations amusing in that there's the ones that are clearly useful as soon as you look at them. Excuse me. Like the alien is trying to figure out what is going on in people's minds and if it's real or not. Like you get your military man who can fight when you get into a scrap. The private investigator, the journalist, the scientist. And then I just really enjoy that there's always the dilettante. A character that it's... I've played them before, and it's funny because it's always like, well, why are you here? And it's like, well, I'm the plucky go-getter. So, the dilettante always amuses me. However, if I was making a character for this, I think I'd want to play the archaeologist.
Oh, nice.
The one who saw the carvings on these ancient walls and now might be plagued with dreams and is going to see the alienist for assistance, because, man, it's left me shaken.
You know, the whole Tutankhamun myth of, what was his name? The doctor who drug him out. Right, that died.
Carter
mysteriously. Carter. It's like, did he just lose his sanity? And what happened to him? Why did it happen? You know, what did he really discover down there? That's a great setup right there.
Well,
yeah, archaeologist would have been my second choice, just to be the old. Is it Brendan Fraser who played him in The Mummy? Yeah, be that kind of a character.
Although I will say in The Mummy, Brendan Fraser's character wasn't the archaeologist. He was much more of the military man. It was
Rachel Weisz and her brother.
Her dilettante brother.
Her dilettante brother. And then she was the archaeologist librarian / professor.
I think dilettante's perfect too, because it's not the poor farmer who has these problems. It's the people in high society who have the money to travel the world and discover things and collect these rare artifacts that then abuse their dreams.
Right.
So it's perfect.
Now, we should talk just a little bit. We're going to talk more as we get into the dials later. I don't want to steal Becca's thunder. But there are dials in Trail of Cthulhu, much like there are dials that we're going to talk about in Night's Black Agents. And what the dials are tuning in your game to a specific style of play. And so the occupations, some are very appropriate for a purist game. Some are more appropriate for a pulp game. We'll talk about that a little later. And so once you pick your occupation, it gives you some things. You're able to, you get a special ability. It sets your credit rating, which is how wealthy your character is. And then it gives you abilities that are cheaper for you to buy. Basically, you get more out of spending your build points there than other characters do. Now, the other thing I really like about, and this is, I love Trail of Cthulhu and I love Call of Cthulhu. But one thing I definitely think Trail of Cthulhu does better than Call of Cthulhu is drives. Every character has to pick a drive. This is the why are you doing this reason? And it goes on your character sheet. And the GM can go, you may not want to go into that tomb, but don't you have a thirst for knowledge? And so the drive is the hook that the player sets in their own mouth to allow the GM. It's part of the social contract of Gumshoe saying, yeah, I will go into the tomb. I will read the book. I will see what that thing that goes bump in the night was. Love that.
Right. Right. Because if we're honest, we as somewhat intelligent, well-thought people would go, no, I'm not going to go into the tomb where I heard the scream and the like raspy breath come out of. Like, no, that's a stupid idea. And I'm especially not going to go into the tomb where I heard that scream and that raspy breath on a full moon without a flashlight or a gun. Like, but my character will.
Yes, yes. Deny. No, I'm just going to sit here and go to work, and I don't care what they found in Machu Picchu. I don't care. Don't want to go there. I'm fine. What's for dinner?
Right.
The drives are great.
Well, and then the next is building our characters' general and investigative abilities. Mark, can you give us a quick walkthrough on the difference between the general and the investigative abilities one more time in case people are jumping in now, having not listened to episode 1 and 2?
Sure. Investigative abilities include the academic, interpersonal, and technical abilities you have. They always work and use them to gather the clues. And you will have some points in those if you want to do some spends, and we'll talk about that later. But basically, those are the skills you have to find the clues, be it because you're a librarian or you have, bargain, bureaucracy, evidence collection, something to gather you the clues. General abilities are the rest, the running, jumping, shooting, driving, and that also includes your health and sanity. For those, you actually use, or you in the game, we call it testing them to create drama, because they can fail, and if you've watched any of our games, they will fail.
Yeah.
Believe me, they'll fail, especially with JM running it. Doesn't control your dice, but inevitably you will fail when you need to.
That's right.
Dramatically.
I spend of time shaving just the slightest amount from Mark's dice every week.
That's right. That's right. So those are your two kind of abilities. You have different build points for them. Your investigative skills depends on how many players are in the group. If there's two, there's 24 points to spread out. Three is 18, and four plus is 16.
Right.
You could cover most of them. I don't know if you'll cover all. I didn't do the math on it, but right. You have a lot of points to spread around, depending on how many you have. And the general abilities, everyone starts with 65, and you spread them out how you see your character. So, yeah, just because you're not the military and you're the alienist doesn't mean that, you know what, I grew up in the mean streets of New York and or Chicago. I know how to shoot. I don't fight very well as far as scuffling, but I know how to shoot a gun because, you know, it's gangster era. So you can put points in it if you want. It'll just cost you more because that's probably not one of the skills you get, one of the abilities you get when you pick an alienist or an archaeologist or something. So there is that.
And there's
also see how the points are spread out later.
Well, yeah, and they split up sanity, which is there's just sanity in Call of Cthulhu, and they split up sanity between sanity and stability in Trail of Cthulhu. And stability is sort of your how shell-shocked am I in the moment? Sanity is so stability loss is from everything, seeing dead bodies, weird noises, seeing a mythos monster. Sanity loss kicks in when the mythos is involved and your stability is gone. There are some things that I think just blast your sanity to quote Call of Cthulhu, but it's interesting because they kind of divvy this up. It adds a little bit more of the pulp feel to it, but let's talk about that right now. There's basically three dials in Trail of Cthulhu. There's your basic, how you normally play it. There's purist, which is you're playing as Lovecraft wrote. So, and then there's pulp. Your characters are a little bit more super heroic. Becca, you want to walk us through kind of what the when we set a dial, what does that mean and what does that bring us into, what does that change system wise for us?
Well, it's as you said, you got your basic, anyone who has read a lot of Cthulhu, seen it, played it. You know the end is coming. You can probably stop the cultists from enacting the ritual. But, you know, you're not going to be fighting Cthulhu. You're not going to be actually interacting with the great old ones. What you're doing is stopping them from acting directly with the world. So you're putting them back to sleep for another generation. You're sinking the island beneath the waves again. Nothing to physically interact with them, but stopping the circumstances. And when it comes to then the two different dials, I feel like basic is kind of in the middle between those two. And then in one hand, you can swing purist, and it's like a psychological horror. Everything is crumbling down all around you. There's nothing you can really do about that. And just kind of in an example, I guess, of this would be this is when you're going to have like the occupations of, yeah, all these, like the artist, the author, the journalist, the professor, a lot of these professions where you're thinking more about it, you're going to be more useful because it's all about what you think is happening. And there's that very much that very real sense of helplessness that you can't stop it. the pulp dial, which is in the opposite swing, you have it's described as desperate actions. Your character has better survivability because they're tougher, smarter, faster than the bystanders. You're going to get into more fights. You're going to get into more really dealing with the physical manifestations of the mythos coming into the world. And you're more, I'm not going to say you're more likely to stop it because that's not true, but you're more likely to be in the room where it happens.
Right. And the purist is Lovecraftian purist. So they're the occupations that you use are only the ones that have actually appeared in a Lovecraft story. If you are playing basic, and what we mean by basic is like rules is written Trail of Cthulhu. If you're playing a purist, you're going to get less investigative points and you're going to get less general build points. If you're playing a pulp, all you get is more general points, because again, the investigative abilities seem to be spread pretty well based off the group size. Let's talk about the investigation skills, because one thing I think it was Mark.
We're going to pause here and we'll be back in 2 weeks with the second part of our introduction and overview to Trail of Cthulhu.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.